Hello, this is Frankly Speaking, an informational exchange of relevance to people everywhere. Today's program addresses the subject of exercise. Is it always good for your health? I'm Helen Ackerman for George Mason University. Do you get up in the morning, pull on a sweatsuit and jogging shoes and take to the streets? Or do you stop at the gym or health spa for a workout on the way home from work? If you do either of these things, you are not alone. Americans have become fitness fanatics, jogging, swimming, playing tennis, running in marathons. According to a recent Gallup poll, over 50% of the adult population exercises daily. But there's a darker side to this enthusiasm for activity. Incautious exertion has led to death for some. More commonly, it leads to injury. In fact, many injuries, tennis elbow, runner's knee, sprinter's shin, swimmer's shoulder, are household words. Fred Schack, Associate Professor of Health and Physical Education at George Mason, is with us today to discuss exercise, its benefits, and its possible pitfalls. With us also is Dorothy Langdon, a writer and librarian, once an enthusiastic jogger who is the victim of an exercise injury. Fred, we all assume that exercise is good for us. Is it?
Well, I think for most of us, we could probably use the exercise and it would be beneficial. But I'm sure that there are those that because of their particular physical condition, in terms of pathological condition, they may have a disease that wouldn't allow for that. If they have extreme arthritis, their exercise is going to hurt them. Maybe in a pool setting, but if they don't have access to a pool, it's very difficult. Most people can stretch, but they can't all jog and swim, etc. So for the most part, exercise is going to be beneficial to the body, but there are always those cases where it is not indicated that exercise should be done.
Are some people not physically built to exercise or to do some forms of exercise? I mean, just their genetic formation is not really good?
Well, there are a number of people who have a structure that allows them, based on the mechanics or the way their body has been engineered, that allows for smoother movement. Their neuromuscular system is better put together, so to speak. But then there are others that it is more difficult for them to exercise because of the way we'll say that the leg bone fits into the hip, and the way the hips are spread out or not spread out, and it can be more difficult to exercise because of the structure.
Dorothy, you hurt yourself while jogging. What did you do?
Well, I started out deciding that it was time I had more exercise and needed to lose weight. And I've never been one who likes to diet, so I thought, well, this is the perfect solution. I can just run it all off, which I proceeded to do. I started out running, I would say, half a mile a day, and then I started working up to a mile a day and 2 miles a day. And what I did was decide that I could just run anywhere at any time, and I thought I'd discovered a great method of transportation also, because I was running to work and to school, and I was going on sidewalks, I was going up and down hills, and I later found out that the worst thing you can do is to run up and down hills and on sidewalks. I was wearing jogging shoes, but it didn't seem to make any difference, and after a while my knees started to bother me, but I ignored that and just kept running, and then it got so bad that I couldn't walk. So at that point I stopped and went to an orthopedic doctor and discovered that I had been causing more injury by continuing to run when I had the first pain, and that was when I should have stopped.
Fred, is Dorothy's experience common, do you think?
I would say it's probably more common than we really realize. Those individuals who don't end up going to a doctor but who stop exercise because of pain. And pain is a limiting factor, and that limiting factor can be either literal physical pain, such as Dorothy had with her knees, or it can be just the discomfort of breathing hard. Some people just can't stand it. It's just too much for them. But I'm sure that most people experience a certain amount of pain and go through that pain. Eventually, they learn to tolerate it. But in this case, Dorothy's pain actually stopped her because she couldn't move because of it, which was, she did the right thing. There are things that can be done, and in her case, it would be probably more beneficial for her and to have started. And one would be to, if you're not sure just how to start a program, you can consult at your local university to speak to a person like myself or an exercise physiologist who'd be able to give the basic information on, you know, how to start a jogging program.
I think that's very important, Fred, because I think most people are under the misconception that running is something that's so simple. Why do I need to find anything out about it? It seems very natural. And so you just start running. And it is definitely something that you need some information about.
You do. And in particular, shoes. You know, there are people just start jogging. I've seen people jog in plain old deck shoes, and my soles, my feet, my ankles hurt just watching them, and I turn away because it's too much. I see them jogging when they're extremely overweight, and the pounding that the joints take from the ankle, the knee, and the hip is just, if you could see what's going on in there, if there were little men trying to cushion your knees and they're holding their hands up saying, stop, stop, you see. Whereas really they don't have to jog. They can actually walk and get the same benefits.
How do you find a good jogging shoe? I think that's one thing that puzzles a lot of people.
Well, what I tell the people that I work with, that if they do intend to do any movement across the earth and they believe they will keep it up, then I recommend that they go out and find a good pair of shoes. And many times you can find them on sale. First, they have to decide, do I want to put some time in walking or jogging? And once they've come to that conclusion, then I explain to them the different name brand shoes that they can look for. But it isn't the name brand. That sets the quality of the product, usually. They should try on shoes until they have one that fits their foot. Don't get a longer shoe just to help the width, because you're going to have a problem at the end of the shoe when you're actually running off the toe. So it takes some time to look for a shoe and get one that fits just right. And if you can't get one, then if you're really intense about it, then you go the orthotic route and have a foot doctor actually build one for your foot, and that's going to run you about $150. But it's going to save you a lot of doctor bills.
That's actually what I did on a lower level. I bought a pair of Dr. Scholl's orthotics, which I placed in my shoes, and they really seemed to help just in walking. Mm-hmm. My problem was diagnosed as overpronation part of the problem, and I understand certain shoes are better than others for that problem. Is that right?
Yes, they'll build into the heel a little more width or a little less width depending on your particular case. And I've seen shoes that have wider heel sole areas than others. And it's just, again, it's the method of which the person runs. They run in pigeon-toed, you know, they're liable to trip, or if they're extremely pronated, they're going to roll the weight too much to the inside of the foot.
What's pronated?
Well, the foot kind of turns outward, and the weight drops to the inside of the foot.
I see. What about people, and many of us are like this, who do a lot of violent exercise on the weekends and then do nothing during the week? Is that bad for you?
I would say that it's probably extremely bad from several points of view. One, you're trying to do everything on the weekend that you didn't do during the week, and that usually creates a disaster. In order to get the benefits from a program, it's best to do a little bit spread out over a longer period of time rather than try to make it intense in one short burst. People have died on golf courses because they think they have to get out and exercise, and they just like golfing. At the end of a golf round, they sit down, and it's all over. They just die right on the spot.
One of the questions, as you're talking, that occurs to me is I've heard so often from doctors who advocate this vigorous exercise to push. In other words, when I started to run, my doctor, when I went for a physical, suggested that I did. And I had told him I tried and I got winded. He said, well, just push past that point. And so the question occurs to me, how do you know which point you're pushing past, whether it's the good point or the dangerous point?
Okay, that's an extremely good question, and it really deserves some consideration, because most people that exercise are not aware of what it is they should be paying attention to. You really have to read your body. And sometimes feelings do not give you a source of reality. Mm. You're breathing too hard. Is that good? Or I'm not breathing hard enough. Is that bad? But what we're really looking at is how fast is your heart going and how fast should it go? So for most people, let's say that we take the person who's 30 years plus. What should be their heart rate in a jogging program? And they're just starting and they haven't done anything for 15 years. If we look back, we only spend about 15% of our time in any kind of a program through high school. And after that, there's a certain amount in college, but really from the age of 22 on, there's nothing unless we choose to do it. So as you start a program, you'll take your age and you'll subtract it from 220. And don't worry about all the where the 220 comes from. If you'd like to know, I'll explain that. But 220 is the top factor for heart rate, maximum heart rate. If you'll subtract your age from that, then you'll get what is considered the maximum heart rate that you should ever attain at any point in your life that year. So if a person is 30 years old and they want to start a program, they know their heart rate should be 220 minus 30, which would be 190 beats a minute. But you don't have to work that 190 beats. When you start a program, your heart rate should be usually 60% of that. And various authorities will vary that from 60 to 70%. But 60% of that, which means that the heart rate shouldn't get above 114 as you start. And that's just that could be a mild or to a moderate walk. It may put your heart rate there. And so that should be checked for a period of time, maybe a month. You have to read your body during this time because you're looking for things that are disruptive to it. And you check the heart rate either at the carotid artery in your neck or the radial artery on your arm just above your thumb on the inside of your arm.
And then would you build up to get it more and more towards that higher rate so that you were stretching your exercise?
Yes, that's correct. The maximum heart rate that your heart should attain in a program is actually 80% of that absolute maximum, which in this case, for a person who's 30 years old, 80% of 190 is 152. 152 is as high as it should ever get, and that is not an uncomfortable range, and you slowly work towards that.
So in the process of running, you would stop at a certain point and then take your
measurement. That's correct. And you take it maybe after 5 minutes and then maybe after 10 minutes, just to see where you are, because you don't know. You're breathing hard, but it's my heart up where it
belongs. It's the heart that counts. I see. Should the weather, the temperature in particular, affect an exercise program?
Absolutely. The drier, cooler weather is always, I would say, would be the best. And as the temperature gets higher and the humidity gets higher, then you have to be a little more careful because the cooling mechanism that the body has does not function well, because the sweat that gets on the outside of the body, which is to cool the skin, never evaporates. It just stays there. And those of you that have, you know, ever been in a humid climate know it's very fatiguing, in which case you're going to need more water, you're going to need more frequent rest, and on bad days, you shouldn't even exercise.
Thank you both very much for coming to the program today. Our time is up, I'm afraid, though it's a fascinating subject. We could obviously talk longer on it. You've been listening to Frankly Speaking, a public affairs program produced by George Mason University. Production coordinator Pat Ping. For information about our guests or this program, please call area code 703-323-2138. That's 703-323-2138. I'm Helen Ackerman for the State University in Northern Virginia. Thank you for listening.